Hello.
Hello, Dan. It is spring. It's here. It's incredibly weird to be recording with you while the sun is up. I don't know why. It's just kind of like making me feel uncomfortable. I'm like, should I not just be sat at my desk in front of a computer podcasting? The answer is no. I need to be doing this, Dan, even if it is a beautiful day outside.
Is it a beautiful day? It's raining here.
Haha.
It was basically raining in the morning. It's basically spent the first 3 months of this year raining where I am. Which is funny to think that when the first winter that I spent here, we were in a permanent drought. But now, there you go.
Yeah, rapid swings between
Cornwall.
Extremes.
It's wet. It's wet in Cornwall. It rains. There you go.
It was just recently, just a quick update for the listener. It was the most holy day of the year, which is, Dan, the day after the equinox. And can you tell me why it's the most holiest day of the year?
Is this the day you choose to plant your potatoes?
It is the day I choose to plant my potatoes. It is potato day. And I revel in the looks that I get from people. He's planting his potatoes early.
Oh, it's not ire you receive. It's not envy exactly. It's
wow.
Like, ooh, yeah. Yeah. He's brave. What a fool.
Yeah, well, his potato plants are going to die. Wow, look at him. It's been incredibly mild here, so I think we should be fine.
We've had no frosts, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Vernal equinox, the best time of the year. I got slapped with it yesterday. I was like, it's spring. Spring is the best. It is the best time. I think I said the exact same thing last year. I was like, all of these people who say it's autumn, I understand it. Autumn is cool. Objectively, spring is the best. And here we are. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
New year, new us.
Yeah. Yep. We're in British summertime now. That's my favorite. I realized like I made a slightly verbose, shall we say, or slightly grandiose perhaps statement that the best hour of the whole year is the hour between about 7:30 and 8:30 on the Sunday after. Wow. The clock change.
I know many people who would disagree with you.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Isn't it supposed to be like the most dangerous day on roads?
Yeah. Right. On the roads, it's a bad day for heart attacks.
Oh god.
Or it's a bad day for people with heart problems, I guess.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So why is it the best day? Just because you're like,
it's not the best day. It's not the best day. It's just the best hour. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. When it's like 7 o'clock, 7:30 at night, and it's still daylight, and like,
yeah, fair enough. Yeah. I see it. I see what you're saying.
Nice. This year was not nice because it was raining, as I say. But you know,
well,
anyway,
we had started this year with a new podcast slogan: "New Year, New Us," where we were like, we should actually read some. We should challenge ourselves for once in our goddamn lives. We did that for a little while, fell back on our ultra left bullshit, but now we're back. Mm-hmm. Equinox episode, several weeks too late. We're reading some Isaac Rubin, Dan. Before we get started on this, where's your confidence level right now? Like, get out of 10, like, where are you at right now to talk about this?
Oh, I'm less than normal for sure. Yeah, sure. I was about, and I don't know where I am normally.
I was going to say, you don't have to admit.
I'm sure the people that listen to this podcast know, but like, it's a bit of a roll of the dice whenever we click record. You know, it's just like, let's see where we're at. It's a bi-weekly checking in with ourselves to see like. How we're doing.
Yeah. What sector are we a part of this week?
Oh, well, there is that as well, isn't there? It's like, what are we going to discover about ourselves in the process of like free associating on these various esoteric topics? This one was a challenge. I feel excited by it. I feel like it's taught me quite a lot. Although I'm not sure what it has taught me. Maybe that's where I'm at. I'm like, I feel educated, but I don't know how well I'm going to be able to share that.
Knowledge has been put into your brain.
It's still sort of still percolating and formulating. And in what form is it going to come out?
Yeah, the correct one?
I don't know. I think it's
a material form.
It's part of an ongoing process.
It's dialectical.
What social form? what social form of appearance, the underlying
the knowledge
material relation of ideas in my head take. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I was stood outside the train station the other day, just waiting for my train, and I was holding this book. And well, you should say we read the first section of I.I. Rubin's Essays on Marxist Theories of Value, the bit about commodity fetishism, that section. And I was holding this book, and this dude gets off the train, and he walks over kind of near me, and he starts like smoking a bowl, and he sees that I'm like holding this book, and he comes up to me, and he goes like, hey man, is that a book? And I was like, yeah, it's a book. And he's like, what are you reading? Can I have a look? And I was like, yeah. So I show it to him, and he goes, I.I. Rubin, Essays on Marx's Theories of Value. And then he looks at me, and he looks back at the book, hands it to me, and just walks away. And I was just like, damn, am I a square now? Like, when did that happen? Like, whoa. So that's about where I'm at.
I thought his response was going to be, yeah, that figures. And then,
or his response was, he doesn't properly understand commodity fetishism.
Well, quite. Yes. Yeah. Clearly, he's reading the wrong
like
material.
This pothead value former comes up to me.
He had an ideological objection to it.
I think, you know how, like, you'll often hear people like talk about, like, who was your favorite communist, Russian communist, Soviet communist who like died in the 30s, who was like killed in the purges. I think I got a new
conversation
favorite
people
one.
Have. Okay.
It's a conversation people have. You know, normal people, are they asking this question? I feel like you only ever hear people say Bukharin or whatever, but Rubin. Not great that he was killed in the purges. Not a good thing for humanity. Because maybe now we'll just get right back to it. This book was so clarifying and so well written, and like at least the section that we read, which was again the section on Marx's theory of commodity fetishism, the first like 60 or so pages, takes all of Marx's ideas and, as far as I can tell, very accurately portrays them in a very like dense but not like aggressively so, and just a very like calculated way. The chapters are very short. It's very easy to like read one thing, put it down, think about it, come back, read it. And maybe like the best, it's like presented in the best way, at least that I've found these ideas have been presented in. Because it's straight to the point. He doesn't try to bring in any obviously like ideological predilections that he has, like a lot of people try to do now, like when you try to read Harvey or something like that. But I thought it was good.
He does that thing that I'm always really grateful for, where he'll end he'll end a chapter with a paragraph, and then he'll start the next essay by basically saying the same thing and then carrying on where he's left off, kind of thing.
Yeah. Like, there's some good summarizing, which we love.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing, there's part of me that's always looking, and in some ways always wants to find a kind of esoteric argument, a certain degree of like there's part of me that looks for the mysticism, you know, like there's part of me that I think enjoys an argument because it seems difficult and obscurantist perhaps, and difficult to understand in some way. Maybe this is why I've had several dalliances with like psychoanalysis. But I was just going back over this, and I don't know whether this will make much sense, but like, I feel like he's constantly retouching base with like something very material. You know, he's always like, he's always coming back to and then starting his argument from a position of sort of like scientific analysis of economic conditions, I suppose. Partly, I suppose, because one of the things that he's trying to rebut with this is the argument that's made that Marx in some way is potentially presenting like an almost metaphysical analysis, or like a, I don't know, like a, yeah, non-materialist, or like more fundamentally, I guess, like a utopian rather than a scientific analysis, or like a description of an ideological process rather than a description of an essentially political economic idea. But
I mean, the kind of like, commodity fetishism, I feel like, is, at least in modern kind of like circles, socialist circles, kind of always considered to be this mystical thing. Like when you hear it described, it's described in humanist terms, which I don't think it's not like that bad. And I think that Ruben here is like, he doesn't really spend much time on it, but he's like, that's actually a good thing. But he's like, it doesn't nearly exhaust what commodity fetishism actually is. But I mean, you know, like whenever you hear people talk about commodity fetishism, it's like, you know, you have no idea where the cobalt in your computer is coming from, because it's coming from a really like horrifying place. But it's like, I forget, maybe when we spoke with Mark from Credisticuffs, he mentioned this, but it's like in any like society with a division of labor, that's going to happen to a certain extent, even in socialism, even if we get like the Murray Bookchin commune, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, mm-hmm. So while I really appreciate that kind of humanist element, this did a lot of clarifying for me why commodity fetishism is actually so important to Marx's overall theory of value, and why Ruben starts his book, which is called Essays on Marx's Theories of Value, with talking about commodity fetishism for 60 pages and not with the section that's titled Marx's Theory of Value. Because it's like, I think, what does he call it? He calls it the general theory of production relations of the commodity capitalist mode. And then he also calls it the basis of Marx's whole economic system, especially value. So when I first started this, I was like, why are we starting with commodity fetishism? That's just like the humanist thing. But again, you know, it's the basis of it all.
Yeah, he wants to talk about a particular surface level appearance element of the capitalist mode of production. He wants to talk about value, but he's got to start with this 60 pages of what kind of category is value, what kind of analysis do we have to do to get to the point where we can understand that as a concept. And yeah, we have to go through all of this discussion about like the relationship between social forms and material technical process of production. So there's method in this process in this that we're taken along by Ruben.
Yeah, and I mean, he also, like, before he even gets to that, he has to describe and define what political economy is, right? Because in the Freddie Perlman intro, he really takes pains to like emphasize what Ruben means when he's like, political economy is its own thing, and it's very specific, and it's the thing you need to study if you want to understand, you know, human organization and human societies, right? Because like, you know, if you go to like university or something, if you try to study these things in like a bourgeois sense, you're going to study political science and you're going to study economics. But Ruben makes the point that like political economy is something else, and it's something that is omitted by splitting up political economy into economics and political science. And so, you know, he says that you can't really treat trying to understand the economy as just like trying to study how scarce resources get allocated or how prices get set. He basically says what political economy is trying to do is it's studying the social relations of production. And specifically, and this is the thing that when I really grasped what this meant, it really clarified a lot of kind of Marx's writing for me. He says that what you're trying to do when you're understanding value and commodity fetishism is you're trying to understand how human working activity develops in a specific way and why. And value is the thing that kind of determines human working activity. It's a thing that regulates it to a certain extent, right? At least in commodity and like commodity production and capitalism, right? It's structured in a good way where all of the arguments really build off of each other, because I do think that like starting with the definition of what political economy actually is very clarifying. Even for, I think, us, and we've been reading this shit for like 3 years. So.
I guess it's worth reiterating that I consider myself in no way expert in these. This material, both Ruben or Marxist political economy in general. always an important caveat to make, I suppose. In some ways, I was caught out by the progression of the argument in this, because despite what I was saying before about him, there always being a sort of materialist touchstone for the argument that he's going through at any particular point, like he'll always refer back to something quite sort of simple and a sort of fundamental materialist point about the capitalist mode of production. There is a transition in this, in some respects, I feel, from a more concrete description into more abstract terminology as you go on. And there's an extent to which I was a bit caught out, partly because of what you were saying before. Often when I end up trying to transpose an argument around commodity fetishism into a language and therefore a critique of capitalism that I can share with people who might not be familiar with this terminology, quite often their response and where I always almost end up in my argumentation is what you're saying before, like a discussion around ethical production around things. Like, and the reason why I often end up in that position is because in some ways, what I always have in mind is not only a critique of capitalism, but a sort of image of what socialism will be, a process whereby workers are connected in one sort of like social production process, I guess, rather than under capitalism, their production relations being mediated through the commodities they produce. And early on in the early sections of this, it sort of feels like because he's talking about very fundamental description of how capitalism works, and he makes certain arguments about what the difference between like feudalism and capitalism and a hypothetical socialist mode of production will be. And he seems to be talking about commodities in terms of like concrete commodities that you will interact with in the world. I feel like the commodity fetishism initially seems to refer to specific commodities, and then it sort of becomes a bit more abstracted. And he talks more around like the various objects of fetishism become more abstract concepts, like wages or capital or value or interest or concepts like that. I feel like we've strayed away from giving a general overview of the text now, but there you go. There is this progression toward abstraction in it.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of that general progression in capitalism as well, just in, as it was kind of like subsuming human society, right? So I think maybe we can start by just maybe talking about like generally what his point is and what he's trying to expand on a theory of commodity fetishism, because I feel like everybody, even like a lot of like members of the bourgeoisie, would probably understand and be like, okay, that's kind of a bad thing about capitalism. Like the first element, which is that relationships are veiled by things. I mean, capitalists and the bourgeoisie would like try to get past this element of commodity fetishism by putting like fair trade stickers on coffee, right? By being like, well, we here at McDonald's are sustainably sourcing our chicken paste these days, you know what I mean? Or like, you know, Apple trying to like, I don't know, not use Foxconn. Not that Apple is not trying to use Foxconn, but like trying to get past this certain humanist element of commodity fetishism. Of course, like bourgeois like economics doesn't really understand that what's being veiled are social relations. They just see the like material, the really terrifying material technical aspect of production and go, oh wow, like consumers don't really recognize how horrible of a environmental process it is to make your computer or to do this or to do that. Maybe we should try and make that a bit better. But the thing that Rubin really emphasizes early on is that that isn't just what commodity fetishism is. He says that it's also that social relations are themselves, they express themselves through things, and that they actually have to be expressed through things in commodity production. And that's kind of his main point here, is he's like, it isn't just that we've stumbled upon this place in capitalism where social relations are just veiled. They have to be veiled by commodities. And capitalism basically works by things interacting with things. Although, of course, that's masking real social relations that are going on behind that process of exchange and process of production, right? So that was a moment where things kind of clicked for me, where I was like, oh, it's actually entirely necessary for this to happen in capitalism. and just kind of like kicked a lot of the, you know, more like reformy elements that still cling to my brain, like, out, because it's like, no, things actually can't work any other way in capitalism other than a healthy dose of commodity fetishism. So,
yeah. And that sort of comes back to those statements of his that you said at the start, why he caveats this with, or why he sees so fundamental, why he sees the idea of commodity fetishism as being so fundamental to an understanding of political economy and how capitalism functions. Because for him, this kind of relationship to things, to commodities, is almost like an inevitable outgrowth of how a capitalist economy is organized. And so, like, yeah, he go in, like, the as you were saying before, like, he gives this very basic, in the first chapter of this, I think it is, he gives this like a basic description of how capitalism functions, and he sort of it's almost like in a continuum between feudalism or prior modes of production and the sort of almost like socialism and some future mode of production. And it's an argument that we're quite familiar with, I think, where he's basically just saying that under capitalism, you have economic conditions whereby people produce things privately, but the things that they produce are not for private personal consumption, they're for social consumption. So you have a form of economic organization, which is, in the history of capitalism anyway, has grown toward being a global process whereby producers are connected all over the world, and the number of elements that make up an eventual commodity that reaches a point of consumption includes things that have been worked on by hundreds or thousands or however many people. And so what you have is almost like a socialization of production. Like, production has become a totally social activity. But it's still done under conditions whereby production itself at any point is a private activity, whereby producers only have any communication with each other when they engage in a market exchange, when they take the thing that they've produced and try and pass it on to some other producer. And so he starts off his analysis with this basic description of capitalism, whereby the only contact point, the only communication, the activity which coordinates that total social reproduction of society that happens under capitalism, the activity that coordinates that is a simple exchange of commodities. And as an extension of that, what you get is the thing, the commodity, and its interaction with other commodities seems to be the thing which then comes to actually direct the productive activity of people. Like, it's not one producer tells another producer, I need this number of things, but rather through price signals and through sort of like global comparison of commodities, that you get the actual organizational the organization of production itself, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think well said, because like he does something that I think is one of the most useful things I've ever seen in terms of like outside of Marx, in terms of like actually understanding the issues with capitalism. When he goes through, there's this one chapter called The Objective Basis of Commodity Fetishism, and it could just as easily be called The Objective Basis of Commodity Production and Capitalism, because he says that there are two things that you need to have for commodity fetishism to become a thing, and indeed for, you know, commodity production to become a thing, and that's private property and exchange. And so what you're saying is exactly true, because it's like, you know, all production is being done in little isolated units that have no real connection to each other at all. And they're all, in fact, in competition with each other, right? And it's not like capitalists have a little book where they go, oh, excellent. I'm producing my commodity just below the socially necessary labor time. This is excellent for me. Oh, darn, I'm just above. Because everybody's in competition and nobody's in communication with each other, there's actually no way for a capitalist to know, because of private property, what they're going to get back for their product in terms of value until they actually take it to the market and take it to be exchanged. And I think that that's kind of what he means when he's like, commodities actually don't just hide the relations between people. Because, you know, when you go to the market, it's not like if you're like a capitalist and you're trying to exchange your product, it's not like you are there as a capitalist. You're there as somebody selling that specific commodity, and the person buying it is somebody buying that commodity, right? It's not like the whole process of capitalism is laid out for everybody to see all of its exploitation. All you're there, man, is I'm just the guy selling this commodity. I'm just the guy buying the commodity. I got nothing to do with the whole fucked up supply chain or anything like that. But he also says that it's not just that the commodity is hiding those relations, but it's actually organizing them because, again, of this kind of like unknown aspect of value and of socially necessary labor time that only really becomes apparent in the act of exchange. Because if you're like out there with your factory making TVs and you're making them in like way above the socially necessary labor time, you might have an inkling that you're kind of fucking up. But like when you take it to the market and you try to sell it, you're not going to get back all of the like quote unquote value that you need to reproduce yourself. And because of that, like if you're fucking up and you're producing way above the socially necessary labor time, you're going to go out of business. And it kind of would appear as though it is the commodity in this act of exchange that is organizing society, that is like putting you out of business, and that is disciplining producers and making sure that, you know, capitalist firms don't just like slag off all day and like do whatever they want. It's actually like disciplining producers to continue to be more productive. Even though it just seems like all that's going on is the same thing that's always gone on, which is people buying things for money. They did that all the way back in ancient Greece. You know what I mean? How could this be any different? This is like, it's Neo-Smithian bullshit, right? But as Ruben says here, like the same phenomenon can show up in different time periods, but take on a completely different social form. And that's what's going on here. So yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he says some very simple things. He makes a comparison between how a capitalist firm or enterprise functions and the transfer of goods that might happen between one element of a firm and another element of a firm as being something that's in some way seems to be like his prototype for a socialist economy, only in the sense that like the relation between people is sort of predetermined by the structure of the corporation that they work for, kind of thing. So like one production wing of a company just passes the products of its portion of the production to another for them to continue working on. And for Ruben, like socialism is that process writ large throughout all of production, I guess, in the sense that like there are determined production relations, I think is a piece of terminology that he uses, like that, like as opposed to under capitalism, whereby people produce and they don't really know who it is that they're going to sell to until they till they take their product to market, kind of thing. So those relationships don't exist ahead of time, kind of thing, but only exist during exchange.
Yeah, and also like why you get, you know, we all remember at the beginning of COVID when it was like 50,000 tons of potatoes had to be burned because there were no buyers for these potatoes, even though like obviously a bunch of people were going hungry. It's because there was no real way for anybody to kind of understand where their product was going to go. I mean, this happens even in the best times. Like maybe COVID isn't even the best example. Like somebody might be like, hey, kids these days, they're buying a lot of fidget spinners. Maybe I'll just make a bunch of fidget spinners. But then by the time they get to the actual market, it's like, oh, wait, no, nobody actually wants my fidget spinners.
Or I was nobody asked for your fidget spinners.
Yeah, goddamn. No fidget spinners in socialism. but I mean, this, I'll just reemphasize again, like I do think the objective basis for commodity fetishism stuff, private property exchange, is so important. And I think that the kind of element of commodity fetishism that we find in exchange is just like a really obvious basis that people can really concretely see for the irrationality of capitalism. Because when you are a capitalist and you appear in the market as not a capitalist, but as a seller of a commodity, you have total like not justification, because it isn't actually justification, but you totally have the ability to just be like, hey man, you know, I it's like Werner von Braun being like, hey man, I just build the rockets. I don't care. I have nothing to do with where they get sent. If they get sent, you know, on like poor villages, that's not my problem, because I'm just the guy designing the rockets. But it's like, well, you know, that is just commodity fetishism. It's pretending that like, you know, you are somebody who just, it's the commodity doing these things. It's the market doing these things. It'll all sort itself out, when in reality, it's like, this process makes it very difficult for people to actually recognize that they're part of a massive production process and not just somebody selling a single commodity. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything else. Do you want to say anything else about exchange in here and how it relates to commodity fetishism?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, excellent.
I guess we've covered it then.
Yeah, we've done it. We've sorted it all out.
Got it.
It's funny how the objective basis stuff really rhymes with a lot of the kind of like left communist stuff that we've read, like the Councilist stuff, I mean. Because the whole point in the fundamental principles is getting past private property and production for exchange. And kind of like using that as its touchstone for a socialist society. Every now and then in here, Ruben will kind of like mention something about what socialism is. And it's kind of like, are you just talking about the Soviet Union? Is that what you mean? Like, are you just talking about like big plan input output tables, and the plan actually doesn't actually work, but that doesn't matter. But it's interesting. I mean, like, it's very easy to see where you can get to a kind of like GIC understanding of things from here. Mm-hmm.
I mean, in some respects, what it chimes with a little bit is the kind of like, monopoly capitalism, like capitalism in its natural development will develop big enough monopolies that they do that thing which I was describing before, which is the monopolies come to be the thing that defines the or fixes the relationship between producers, and it's no longer something that's facilitated by the market. And obviously this was an idea that was sort of prevalent at the beginning of the 20th century amongst certain wings of socialism, like capitalism in and of itself is creating the conditions for socialism because of the monopolies that are being formed in these enormous firms, kind of thing. So I think there's an element of that going on, but also, yeah, when I was describing before, like the distinction between exchange versus like transfer of things, I was thinking about that difficulty we had when we were reading the fundamental principles of like saying, well, under the sort of GIC proposals, they are exchanging things, but then it's not exchange under the same conditions of as under capitalism, right? It means a different thing, but there are parallels, I suppose. And so the aspect of that it does chime with is this idea that like a transition to socialism is discovering parallel socialist means of achieving similar things, but undermining the fundamental like value relationship that lies underneath them, I guess, or undermining the I can't quite remember how he does it, but like he gives a definition of socialism as being a sort of a unity between production and social form. Whereas he's suggesting, I think, under capitalism that there is this separation between the sort of material technical basis of how production takes place, and then the social form of that activity, the sort of like social conventions that govern and sort of like organize that material technical process. And I think that separation is the separation represented by commodity fetishism, in the sense that, like, as we've been saying, like, there is this not just illusory, but also like fundamentally necessary separation between the organizing element. The thing that organizes production is necessarily separate from the production itself in some respects.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing just to touch on too, I think to clarify his kind of definition of socialism, or to maybe just talk about, I don't know, a different definition of socialism, is like the kind of monopoly capitalism stuff I've never really quite understood, just because like even when you have like vertically integrated firms, it still seems like they would be expecting their different subsets to like be productive as it relates to socially necessary labor time. Like it doesn't seem like socially necessary labor time goes away just because it's part of one big firm. Like I've never really understood that. And I like even, I mean, this is most obvious in something that isn't a firm like Walmart that isn't actually vertically integrated, but like it's kind of vertically integrated because it has such monopoly on distribution. Like it expects its, you know, commodity producers to produce to a certain point. That's like in its contracts with them, I would imagine. And if they, you know, drop below that point, they can just get dropped and they move on to somebody else. So, and then like the GIC stuff, I think this is kind of what it, this is how it kind of was clarified for me, the exchange versus transfer stuff, is because like the transfer, all that means is it's just firms are communally reproduced. You just get what you need and it doesn't matter how productive you are or unproductive you are. That's kind of like the key of it. It's like, are you rewarding people for their productivity or not? And in like market socialism, you are. And it's like, okay, well, that's, you know, you're kind of like halfway back to capitalism there. It's just much less stable. Whereas in like a GIC thing, it's like transferring. Going back to your main point, which is about the kind of like material technical stuff, I found it so interesting how he was like, you know, he counterposes the material technical aspects of production with the social form, which is exactly what you're saying. And he does that thing that you actually clarified for me a long time ago, which is that like what Marx was trying to do was go, here's what an economy does. All economies, they all do this. They all do these certain things. Here's what capitalism does. And that was Marx's like main research project. That's what capital is, right? That's him trying to be like, this is, these are the things, the social form of production that are specific to capitalism and commodity production. And, you know, you can go back and do that with feudalism. You can go back and do that with kind of anything that you want. And the thing that was so interesting about this is when he starts talking about that kind of duality, is when he starts talking about like more bourgeois economists, and he's like, everybody other than Marx makes the exact same mistake. They confuse these two things. They confuse what an economy is always versus what's specific to capitalism. And you know, you and I come across this all the time when we do reading on history, because it's like, when did capitalism begin? It began with the Big Bang, baby, because we've always done it. And it's like, well, actually there are things that are really specific to capitalism. And like, you know, I don't know, somebody 2000 years ago who was like paid 5 gold coins to like plow a field or something. There's a reason that that's kind of different to what capitalism now, even though it's like the same phenomenon, just given a different social form. And I mean, yeah, it's just very interesting because like, I don't know, he's talking about this from a standpoint of trying to combat bourgeois economists who are critical of Marx's theory of commodity fetishism and who do that typical either humanist thing of being like, commodity fetishism is when I don't know where my bananas came from, or commodity fetishism is like when I feel bad because, you know, the like animal products that I eat come from like torture and genocide or whatever. Whereas he's like, that's just confusing the material technical process of production with the social form it takes under capitalism, which is commodity fetishism, I guess. That sounds smart. I'll just say that.
What's funny, the funny experience I had reading this book is he starts this book by pointing out something that's been recognized by a lot of other people, which is that there is a fundamental parallel between like Marxist or Marx's formula of historical materialism and how history develops as this sort of contradictory relationship between relations of production and I always forget these two terms, like the sort of like the the means of production versus the production relations, you know? Is it a development of technology, or does like do the social relations of a mode of production come into contradiction with the sort of like technical material, technological developments in a society, and this leading to historical development? And then he's pointing out that there's a parallel sort of between this and Marx's sort of basic formulas for understanding political economy as being distinction between an appearance level set of relationships between things in an economy, like a whole series of forms that things come to take, a series of like commodities become bearers of value, and commodity seems to have this thing, this quality of being valuable, you know, or like means of production seem to in and of themselves be able to create surplus value, or like the sort of the technical production process, or like land seems to be able to bear a rent, an income for the people who own it, kind of thing. And that sort of surface level appearance, these are the things that seem to be qualities of objects in the world, for Marx are actually the necessary form in which social relationships between people take under capitalism. Like the only way we can interact with and understand relationships between people under capitalism is through their appearance level form in the qualities of things. And for Ruben, what he's saying is that there's this similarity between Marx's political economy and Marx's historical materialism, in that they sort of contain these two sort of contradictory dialectical, I don't know, relationships between these two things. But what that leads to, coming back to what I was saying, what this leads to in reading this book is it's sort of like peppered throughout with all these comments on things that you would recognize as being like commentary on history. There's so many descriptions of development of mode of production, how different mode of productions function and how they differ, what it is that defines any economic form of activity, what the things which are necessary in any mode of production, which he kind of describes as just like a simple bringing together of, I think he identifies some fundamental elements like land, labor, means of production. You need to find some way of bringing these things together in a way which they produce or reproduce what it is that society needs. And then also he says that there are things that are fundamental to specific modes of production to define how they function. Yeah, he talks about land, labor, and means of production, and the necessity of bringing them together to have a mode of production, I guess. And he says that under feudalism, you have the land is owned by the landlords, and the means of production and the labor are united in one class. He also says that there are more fixed relations of production because, like, serfs are tied to certain pieces of land. They're required by law and by tradition to provide certain labor to certain landlords, I suppose. And then the fundamental point that he's making is that one of the key developments that happens between the transition from feudalism to capitalism is that on a certain level, everybody becomes to some degree equal, in the sense that everybody is recognized as being the owner of, the bearer of some commodity. Everybody becomes defined by the type of commodity that they own. And obviously, like, the capitalist own means of production, and it's that ownership, that relationship to means of production that makes them capitalists. Workers only own their labor power, and they don't own means of production. They're proletarians, and therefore they're defined as a particular class. And he does talk about like landowners, but I guess you could extend it to anybody who is an owner of something and extracts a rent as a result of by right of owning that thing. But on a fundamental level, everybody appears as and interacts with others fundamentally as an owner of something first and foremost and exclusively almost. And so it comes to be the point where it's just those things that are interacting to some degree rather than the people, I guess.
Yeah, that actually clarifies a big thing for me, you saying that, because he talks about commodity fetishism, the fetishism of the commodity, but then he also talks about this idea of the reification of people. And I guess it's exactly what you're talking about, right? Because like commodity fetishism, we've talked about it. It's how the commodity appears to have all of these supernatural powers. It seems as if the commodity is the thing that's organizing everything. But then he talks about reification of people, and he basically says it's when social relations are like perceived as inherent attributes of the people, of people themselves, of specific people themselves. So it's like, that guy is a capitalist. He is the capitalist. The capitalist does this. And that actually kind of got me thinking, because it's like, I think maybe this is just people's first instinct at work, right? Where it's like, I mean, this has always been my experience with trying to talk to people about like either in union efforts or in like just general like shit stirring efforts at work. Like whenever you try to talk to somebody about, hey, work's pretty shitty, huh, man, this shit fucking sucks. They're always like, yeah, man, our manager's just terrible. Our manager sucks. It's just our goddamn boss. They suck. And like, I'm going through this right now with union stuff. People are just like, man, if only we could just replace the big boss, everything would be fine. Or like at every other job I've ever had, people have always just complained about that specific boss that they've had. And I think that that's actually kind of a certain type of reification of people where it's like, this person seems to be the thing that is, you know, making your life shitty. And that is the con. It's not that they're the conduit of capitalism, right? It's just that they are one specific person acting against you in a very concrete way. Whereas in reality, they are a conduit of capitalism. They're a conduit of capital. And the reason you know that is because if they weren't, they would be replaced by somebody who was, right? Like people need to act in a certain way to keep up with the needs of accumulation, no matter where you work. And so I think that that kind of leads to a certain type of reformism and also like knee-jerk, I suppose just like knee-jerk reformism in worker struggles, and is always kind of like the first step in kind of like radicalizing any given workforce. And it is kind of like, you know, it plays into that distinction of like overcoming the reification of people, and commodity fetishism is like maybe the thing that is necessary to make the working class the class for itself, as opposed to the class in itself. I kind of always come back to that as like a barometer for like how to make that happen. Maybe if we just make enough podcasts, we can do that. But apparently it actually has something more to do with political economy, which is a bit frustrating.
So am I right? So I've always been a bit confused by the idea of reification. Am I right? Can you clarify for me? Am I right in thinking that like all that reification means is that process of people becoming defined by the thing that they own, kind of thing? Like,
yeah, I think it's
you don't have to be the definitive
oh god
person who understands the thing, but like Jack Luke between Ash. The two of us,
you know? We really put our brains together. I mean, I think I understand it because literally it just means thingification. It mm-hmm. becomes a thing, right? So it's like, it's not quite a concretization. It's almost like an abstractification, but it is a like, this concept becomes a thing, and it has this kind of like, ah, there it is. This is no longer, you know, like Doug, my manager. This is like, a manager, right? I suppose it's something like that. It's like the capitalist becomes the evil capitalist. It becomes not just the conduit of a broader set of social relations. It becomes that evil person. That's like my general understanding of it, at least. It's, yeah.
I just found a little bit in my notes where I've written production relations reified / crystallized. I think that's the two words he pairs together, and the idea of it being a process of crystallization would imply that it's like that sort of fixing and then into a social form. So it's like, I think the reification is this thing which it sort of describes, mediates this process whereby a production relation, a relationship between people, becomes fixed into a particular social form. And I guess social forms are, it's in another way of describing the qualities of things.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Yeah. I think it's when you perceive these historically specific categories as inherent of a specific group of people or person. It's like, you know, we don't talk about capitalists, we talk about job creators, right? We talk about these people that have always existed and that are like entrepreneurs instead of like conduits of capital, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he does talk about, he says an interesting thing that we should attach to this line of argument, which is like particular things that we recognize as categories can actually fulfill multiple different social forms, kind of thing, based on the thing that they're in relation to. So I suppose like money can fulfill the form of like rent or interest, but also if it's in a particular relation to a worker and fulfilling the reproduction of the worker, then it just takes the form of a wage kind of thing. But then if it's something which it's actually being used to acquire means of production or other things that are material elements in a production process, then it can sort of take the form of capital. So he does point out that like things can transition from being one social form to another predicated on the underlying relationship. And I think one of the things that he's saying is that's one of the confusions that can be made if you don't see the social relations that underlie. No, you don't see the, I don't want to say social relations because I was about to say social form. So maybe social is the wrong word.
Oh no. Get the thesaurus.
This was the biggest problem that I had reading this whole thing, is like, am I encountering him just using a different word for the same thing, or is he actually saying something else? Because there's a point in, I think it's in chapter 2, when he's talking about socialism and he's talking about the relationship between producers being one where they have like a fixed social relationship or something like that, a fixed production relationship or something, as opposed to one which is mediated by the market. And at the beginning of the next chapter, he talks about under capitalism, people do have, there is a determined production relationship. And I was a bit suddenly, I thought you were just saying they didn't have determined production relationships and actually it was all mediated through the market. But I think
those I read this in the original Russian Dance.
You'll have to. Well, maybe that's what it is, you know, like, is it, who knows? Is it translation error or?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe it's something to be overcome, gotten past, looked past rather than like,
it's overcome in the dialectical process of production. Yeah. That's what I took. When I read that sentence, I was just like, whoa. the social forum stuff is interesting, though, just to touch on what you're saying. Like, you know, he makes the point that like a loom in like the house of a frontier homesteader in America who's making everything for themselves, that's not capital. Right? A loom that's just sitting there isn't capital. But once it is owned by somebody who is employing wage labor, then that becomes capital, right? So this is his way of saying like these specific material technical aspects of production, you can't confuse them with the social form that they're given, because otherwise you're just going to confuse everything. You're going to be like, well, money's always existed, so capitalism's always existed. Checkmate, communist. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting. And it, you know, and it speaks to this thing that's always tripped me up like a lot, even when I think I understand it, where it's like, things can have a price but not a value, right? Because it's like, well, money's just fulfilling this role now that isn't really specific to like I don't know, maybe commodity production or something, where it's like Marx uses the example in Capital of like somebody's honor or consciousness has a price and that doesn't have a value. Technically land doesn't have it might have potential value based on how shitty it is or how good it is to like then engage in commodity production for food production or something, but like, you know, those things can still have a price, and that trips everybody up. And it's funny because like this gets into, I think, the thing that I was thinking about this entire time, which is like commodity fetishism is actually really simple, but then it's also like kind of complicated. Like if you try to explain it to people, because like you'll keep coming up against things like this where it's like, wait, but things can have a price, but not a value. I thought value was supposed to explain price. They're like, wait a minute, money is the material universal commodity that represents value. But I thought we've always had money. We always have capitalism. Like it's a bit confusing. It's like when you first read like Marx's stuff or specifically like Capital, you kind of have to get your brain in like a specific way to understand his arguments. That's just because they don't teach dialectics in school, Dan, like they should. Dialectics 101. But yeah, it's interesting stuff. I guess that's just why you get the humanist argument of commodity fetishism, which is the only thing you ever hear about, which is just like, where are my potatoes coming from? You know, I know where my potatoes are coming from, but where does everybody else, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think the thing that springs to mind there is some things that he says in the final chapters of what we read, where he's sort of like charting Marx's transition from being somebody in his early life who identifies with utopian socialism and Proudhon as compared to the ways in which he matures and comes to refute and argue against utopian socialism and develop a scientific view is exactly what is described at the beginning of this book, where it's like recognizing that the exactly what you were saying earlier, that like the process of sort of like veiling our social relations under a series of relationships between things is not like a process of alienation that simply needs to be overcome, but first we need to recognize it as being fundamental to how capitalism functions. But anyway, yeah, I've jumped ahead a little bit there. But yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that's kind of the main point, right? Which is just that like capitalism and the way that it functions makes people perceive it as natural and normal and the way that things have always been. But in reality, Dan, that's commodity fetishism. So, you know, this is the bugbear of like every like kind of cultural Marxist academic of like, yeah. You know.
Wow. That's where you'd hit like the air horns thing on your soundboard if you had the...
Well, all I was this.
Probably more correct, yes.
Probably more accurate for us to be using that one.
That is the auxiliary statement's air horns.
incorrect. Yes. Is there any... This is the extent of my notes on this book, but anything else for you?
No, where have I gotten to? Where are we at? Where are we?
Where are we at? We figured
it out. The only thing is the sentence, the quote from Marx that hangs over this entire thing for me.
Oh no.
That I think I still don't understand.
Oh no.
Is what it means to say that material relations between persons sort of take the form of social relationships between things. And I still don't have an answer to that.
Well, that's been our episode for this week, everybody. No, I mean, I guess it's just the general idea, right, of like the process of production that's specific to capitalism is masked by, oh, that guy's just going to the market to sell his commodity. That guy is just, you know, they just buy commodities. They just sell commodities. Mm-hmm. And the rational kernel of that thinking is that to a certain extent, you could say from one angle that commodities do actually organize the economy. Although then you would actually kind of have to start thinking about why it is that they organize the economy. What is socially necessary labor time? It's abstract labor. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. That's just its own version of commodity fetishism.
It's the things that have the social life. Is the things that interact with one another, at least on like a appearance level. I suppose one thing, I don't know how clearly we've stated it, but I think the point that Marx is trying to make is like it comes to a point whereby all that you experience are the social relations between things, and it's an underlying element. I suppose that's obvious and what we've been saying throughout, but like, it's not simply that there's like this relationship between the two, but one is preeminent to the other, I guess, in the sense that like it's the social relations that it's the relationship between things and the qualities of things that we interact with and non-Marxist economists analyze without recognizing that there are human relationships that underlie all of these things. And that's it's the sort of fundamental combination that Marx is making between including, and he's sort of the first person to include a kind of like sociological analysis with an economic one. Anyway,
it's funny, isn't it, that like process of, you know, exactly what you're saying, like we just, all we perceive and all that we interact with are these interactions and these social lives of things, but then it is also like our day-to-day lives of like getting up and going to work is a direct interaction of exploitation, but it's hard to recognize that. And like a form of that is, you know, if I work harder, I'll get more money, or this money that I got today was because I did a really good job, or I, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, you're getting paid for the value of your labor power. Like, you know, if you could slack off all day, if your boss didn't notice, and you'd still get paid like the value of your labor power, you know what I mean? But it's, I mean, it's interesting. It's almost like it's dialectical. I'm not going to quite say that, but it's like, yeah, like we experience just like commodities as organizing our lives, and they kind of do, but they also don't. And we have this concrete experience of exploitation. So,
yeah. I'm laughing at the idea that like what you sell is your ability to work, whether you actually provide that or not.
I mean, pretty much.
I'm able to do something. But if you're not going to make me do it.
You know, yeah, actually. Yeah. I mean, that is my concrete experience of, if you aren't going to be there watching me do it, then...
Great.
What are you going to do? Commodity fetishism. The last two chapters in this are interesting, but I don't think.
Yeah, no, sorry.
No,
it's just the necessary chapter that gets included in books where an author has a particular beef that they just want to exercise. And here we are like 100 years later and we've got like no idea. I can't even remember his name. The person that he devotes an entire chapter to. I mean, in some respects, it is an example of mistakes made by bourgeois economists kind of thing, or mistakes, fundamental misunderstandings. But who is that guy?
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Who is this history guy? And why am I reading about it?
I had half a thought for us to like actually talk about the last section, which was Marx's development of this theory. But then I was like, I kind of don't care. it's the theory itself is good enough for me. I don't need to know that it's like, well, in poverty philosophy, he was almost there and he said this, but then in the economic manuscripts, then he really got it. I was like, all right, I'm not interested in this.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that I love, but that's not, I can,
that's
I
your
can
solo
see,
episode
I can certainly see the virtue in not going there for sure.
Well, what are you gonna do? Are we gonna read all of this book eventually?
Oh, are we gonna read all of this? Yes.
Oh, okay. I mean, that was the plan. This was gonna be our new tome.
Well, I have a feeling it's actually just gonna roll straight into the net. Like, I want to see what the continuation, is, kind of thing. Yes. And I also want to get back, like, obviously I started out with the kind of like, this is going to be about my relationship to the things that I buy, you know, like the basic commodities that I interact with on any day-to-day basis. And obviously, as we've described, what I was saying before, like, as we increase through the degrees of abstraction, what we get to is very, like, the actual fetishism of things that he's talking about at the end of these chapters are actually like mistaken relationships to like money or value, or rather a mistaken understanding about commodities in general as like having a value that's intrinsic to them, or like land having certain qualities that are intrinsic to it, or workers and wages having certain qualities that are intrinsic to those. maybe continued reading about value will bring it back to a concrete analysis of like everyday analysis, interaction with things in my daily life, I guess.
Yeah. This book must be about me.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Why else would Isaac Rubin have written this book if not exactly. for me to read it?
Exactly. All right. Well, this book is very...
If that was his intention, I'm sure he's like lamenting that he ever put the effort in because...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I did it for these two buffoons. We're like, this was
really good, except for the quote that starts it. We're like, what the fuck does that mean?
Anyway, I'm glad.
All interesting stuff, and I mean, this is the kind of stuff I feel like you need to read if you actually want to understand the like political economy of socialism. Because while you could easily just be like, big computer cartel, everything sorted out by somebody else, if you apply this analysis, you'll see that that actually doesn't get past like you know, capitalist social relations really in any way. So it's good. It's really really interesting. I wonder what. Yeah. I mean, I wonder what Rubin would have been like if he had survived past the 30s. I wonder what Rubin would have been like if he didn't have the, like, you know, bureaucracy of the Soviet Union breathing down his neck. It would have been interesting to see kind of what conclusions he came to. Mm-hmm.
Maybe he'd have just done a Paul-matic and go and live on a commune and grow vegetables.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, exactly.
Take that route. Take the Kamat way out.
The Kamat way out. God, I wish. I wish I could take the Kamat route out. Baffles me that he's still alive. That is just
is that
like,
true?
Huh? Yeah, I think so. Oh,
let's get him on.
get him on the pod. We couldn't get him within a mile of a computer, I don't think. Somebody would have to run to him with a telegram and be like, sir, two people talked about your book.
Yeah. He's never going to like DM us on Twitter or anything, is he?
Oh my God, I would lose it if he did. He's in the Discord. He pops up in the Discord. It's like, whoa. Yeah. Anyways, I was gonna make an Earth Crisis joke, but that's neither here nor there. Burn the machines. Earth Crisis, good. Kamat, not good.
Yeah. Destroy the machines that kill the forest.
Exactly. Yeah, indeed. We did it, Dan. We talked about value in a coherent, semi-coherent way. I was moderately worried about this. This has been a book that we've been talking about trying to read since we maybe started the show. So look at us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that we did. I mean, I feel like I suggested that we embark on it on a fundamental misunderstanding that it was going to tell me something about like ideology under capitalism. I think that's what my starting point was. After the conversation we had with Mark and that reading about that critique of David Harvey essay, and I came away from that with these sort of like, I should really try and understand ideology under capitalism.
I mean, what this has shown me is that all ideology, all bourgeois ideology, it's commodity fetishism. That's what it is. It kind of is. So,
everything. Think about everything, that. Everything is commodity fetishism.
Everything is commodity fetishism. It's like how everyone's a liberal except for me. Everything is commodity fetishism.
Yes. So,
All right. I think that's long enough, Dan.
Let's give it up. Good enough. Good enough. Long enough, good enough.
Yeah, you have to get back to work. What are we doing? Oh, my God. All right. Talk to everybody later. Thank you, Dan. All right. Hey, everybody. Jack here. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. The song that you heard on this episode is Music to Kill Bad People To by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. You can go ahead and check this song out and much, 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 much more on their Bandcamp at kinggizzard.bandcamp.com. If you want to go ahead and get in touch with us, chat shit, tell us that we're wrong, whatever you want to do, you can go ahead and do that at auxiliarystatements@gmail.com. You can just send us a message there. Or you can get in touch with us on Twitter, on Discord, on Instagram. You're a smart person. You can find these places. We got a YouTube. We post stuff there as well. Sometimes we stream. Thank you so much for listening. Till next time.